Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Now, Prendick, I will explain, said Dr. Moreau, so soon as we had eaten and drunk. I must confess that you are the most dictatorial guest I have ever entertained. I warn you that this is the last I shall do to oblige you. The next thing you threaten to commit suicide about, I shan't do, even at some personal inconvenience. He sat in my deck chair, a cigar half-consumed in his white, dexterous-looking fingers. The light of the swinging lamp fell on his white hair. He stared through the little window out at the starlight. I sat as far away from him as possible, the table between us and the revolvers to hand. Montgomery was not present. I did not care to be with the two of them in such a little room.
You admit that the vivisected human being, as you called it, is, after all, only a puma, said Moreau.
He had made me visit that horror in the inner room to assure myself of its inhumanity. It is the puma, I said, still alive, but so cut and mutilated as I pray I may never see living flesh again.
Of all vile...
Never mind that, said Moreau. At least spare me those youthful horrors. Montgomery used to be just the same.
You admit that it is the puma. Now be quiet while I reel off my physiological lecture to you.
I love the self-awareness of Moreau. I'm just going to talk at you for a long while, and you're going to listen. And I personally wish more people had this amount of personal understanding.
Let the record show that Lackey wants more people to be like Dr. Moreau.
What? No.
You said it. You can't take it back.
Oh, no.
None of the things we say today can be taken back. As we present our third episode on the H.G. Wells novel, The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Welcome to Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I am Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. You're listening to us on Patreon, and we appreciate your support, just as we appreciate the support of our reader today, Andrew Lehman of the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society.
Don't forget to check out their website for all the best Lovecraftiana radio plays, clothing, music, and of course, physical props.
The scholarly monographs that they do are amazing, and our killer game props, too. There's a new one that Andrew was nice enough to send our way. You got yours, right?
I did, yeah.
It is a fascinating account of the discovery of fragments of Kitab al-Azif, the Necronomicon, in the abandoned city of Haran in 1920. The monograph features some great maps of the area, photos, and a color centerfold of the ancient document itself. Those are the kind of centerfolds I'm into. The text is a blend of real scholarship and total fiction. And as the HPLHS says, we think it's a lot of fun. They're right. Yeah. Where are we in this exciting and disgusting book?
Oh, boy. The story so far, Prendick was the sole survivor of a shipwreck. He was picked up by this medical man, Montgomery, who was on a ship headed to the island of Dr. Moreau with a supply of live animals. The captain was a drunk and a jerk and didn't like Montgomery or his weird-looking beast man servant. When Prendick stuck up for them, drunk captain decided he didn't like him either. So when they dropped off the cargo, drunk captain kicked Prendick overboard as well. Montgomery and Moreau took pity on him and let him stay on the island.
Prendick actually knows who Moreau is from some news in the past. He's this notorious vivisectionist, and he was run out of the medical establishment in London. And now he's set up shop here on this island of the Pacific to continue his nasty experiments.
There are all types of dog boys and sloth kids running around, and a puma that is being vivisectioned. Prendick gets it in his head that Moreau is going to turn him into a hog man or something, and he runs off into the jungle, where he finds a whole village of beast men.
These discarded experiment men have a slate of laws they repeat to keep them from acting like animals. They treat Moreau like a god, fearing his wrath and his house of pain. Prendick knows he won't find help there, so considers drowning himself in the ocean. But before he can, Moreau and Montgomery convince him they don't want to hurt him. They give him their guns to prove it, and they lead him back to their camp.
But before he gave up, Prendick told all the beast men that Moreau is scared of them, and that they should throw off their shackles. Well, figuratively, they're not actually chained.
Right. Even though they're being exploited in the worst way, it might have been a bad idea to put that idea into their heads for his own safety.
Yeah. And now we're in chapter 14. Dr. Moreau explains.
The fact that Moreau starts with, I'm going to lay this out and please don't interrupt, kind of lets us know that he's probably tried to explain all this before and been interrupted because it's kind of shocking. But Our narrator starts to fall under the spell. It says he explained his work to me. He was very simple and convincing. Now and then there was a touch of sarcasm in his voice. Presently, I found myself hot with shame at our mutual positions. And hot with shame was, of course, a legendarily disastrous single for Van Halen in the 90s. So much music came out of this book. That was a bad example. But Moreau says, you forget all that a skilled vivisector can do with living things. And he describes how you can use flesh from one part of the body to rebuild other parts of the body. Mm-hmm. And that you can break things down as well as build them up. He's talking about things that are actually viable today through surgery. In fact, I think the word rhinoplasty also comes from this book, which isn't true. But then he talks about grafting parts. He talks about grafting parts of one animal onto another.
And that's where we get into the realms of science fiction, obviously. That cannot work. But there is this great book called Elephants on Acid by Alice Bosie. It goes into all these insane experiments that scientists, I'm using finger quotes there, have performed on animals. And it's total mad scientist stuff.
We've discussed this book before, as far back as our episodes on Reanimator with Stuart Gordon, who, of course, knew all about it. You know, you start talking about crazy experiments and that man just lit up.
Well, in this book, there are numerous experiments involving dogs, keeping a dog's head alive after it's removed from its body, draining all the blood out of a dog's body until it's dead, and then putting new blood back into its body and then bringing it back to life, grafting a dog's head onto another dog's body so it, it's alive. It's pretty crazy.
We've all seen the picture of them growing an ear on the back of a mouse. Like, there's some versions of this that are possible. It's just not surgical the way that Moreau is talking about it. If you ever watch the Westminster Dog Show, though, it's basically a showcasing of all that work you're talking about. Also not true. But dog breeds are a form of weird science in a way, because dogs are bred over time for specific jobs, but others, it's simply aesthetics or, I don't know, it's kind of insane. Like,
it is.
Bulldogs, my understanding is, can only give birth through C-section because their craniums are too large for the birth canal, which is true. That is true. If you put a bulldog bark through a translator, it would probably say, misery made me a fiend.
Poor bulldog.
I know.
This book also talks about Dr. Ilya Ivanov, who, starting in 1927, wanted to make a human-ape hybrid. So first, his plan was to inseminate female chimps with human sperm, donated by, and I quote, a man whose age isn't exactly known, at least not older than 30. But he was doing it on the sly because, you know, obviously this isn't really a good thing to do. And since he was doing it on the sly, his conditions weren't great and it wasn't successful. Eventually, however, he found support for this insane idea, mostly because communists were pro-Darwin and they wanted to show to Christian Americans that apes and humans are really closely related, so closely related that they can interbreed. And this was around the time of the Scopes monkey trial. What they wanted was a human Z. I see that word being thrown around.
That's such a weird way to be helpful. I just think that would have probably backfired. I don't think Christian Americans would have gone, I don't believe any of that stuff anymore. Now that I've seen the human Z.
Ivanov went to, this is unbelievable. He went to the Congo, and there was a hospital there that he wanted to work at, and he was going to, I kid you not, unwittingly impregnate women there, but the hospital wouldn't allow it. Who is this guy, and why would he think anybody would be cool with this?
Well, but the best thing about that is the hospital wouldn't allow it means that he was willing to be deceptive to the patients, but wouldn't go that extra step. He let his boss know.
That's crazy. Since he got stymied there, he decided to ask for volunteers, and strangely, he found a handful of women that were willing to go through this process.
Sure.
And this orangutan called Tarzan was going to be the sperm donor. But fortunately, I say, he died before the experiments could actually start.
They handed him a cup and a copy of Penthouse right in front of his mom, and he died of embarrassment.
So Ivanov went back to Russia to get some more support for this crazy idea of his, but he got swept up in a Stalin purge and was sent to jail for 2 years. He died just right after he got out of jail, so his experiments ended there.
As far as we know.
As far as we know.
Like, if you're on Ancestry.com and you find a Tarzan from Russia up on your family tree, please drop us a note because we'd like to break this story.
Supposedly, chimp and human DNA are actually close enough to interbreed, but this is a rabbit hole I suggest you do not go down. And I have decided, at a point of my research, I'm going to do no more research because I ultimately do not want to know.
Says the host of the podcast that brought you an analysis of Lovecraft's celebrated farce, facts concerning the late Arthur German and his family. I don't think it's that you don't want to know. I think it's that you already know too much.
I do. It's yeah. That's it. True. Now back to Moreau. He explains that all of his beastmen and women are in fact surgically altered animals. It is not simply the outward form of an animal which I can change. The physiology, the chemical rhythm of the creature, may also be made to undergo an enduring modification, of which vaccination and other methods of inoculation with living or dead matter are examples that will, no doubt, be familiar to you. A similar operation is the transfusion of blood, with which subject, indeed, I began. So basically, he's saying by moving parts and fluids around, that they're able to change the way the life form functions. It becomes a new creature.
Prendick responds, "Monsters manufactured!"
Prendick points out that these things talk. So how the heck does that work? And Moreau says that it's by the power of hypnotism. We can program new thought processes and capabilities into these new forms.
An artificial modification and perversion of instinct. Pugnacity is trained into courageous self-sacrifice and suppressed sexuality into religious emotion. And the great difference between man and monkey is in the larynx, he continued, in the incapacity to frame delicately different sound symbols by which thought could be sustained. So, surgically and hypnotically, he's making these creatures able to speak. That seems far-fetched through surgical means, but when I put my 19th century hat on, it seems plausible.
Sure.
My 19th century hat is, of course, a tall beaver. Something else Moreau is doubtless trying to create.
Prendick says, okay, sure, but why make them human? What is the point? And Moreau says, I suppose there is something in the human form that appeals to the artistic turn of the mind more powerfully than any animal shape can. So he's basically doing it because he thinks it's cool.
Just like George Lucas inserting Jabba the Hutt into Star Wars just because you can do it. It doesn't mean you should do it.
Prendick says, you're causing so much suffering that poor Puma is screaming nonstop.
Moreau kind of leans into some cosmicism in order to defend himself.
Oh, but it is such a little thing. A mind truly open to what science has to teach must see that it is a little thing. It may be that save in this little planet, this speck of cosmic dust, invisible long before the nearest star could be attained, it may be, I say, that nowhere else does this thing called pain occur. Why, even on this earth, even among living things, what pain is there?
Moreau then pulls out a knife, and he stabs himself in the leg to prove his point.
He's doing a young Frankenstein move.
That's what I was thinking. Pain is simply our intrinsic medical advisor to warn us and stimulate us.
Remember, Prendick studies natural history, which is all about observation rather than experimentation. Mm-hmm. But Moreau looks down on this. He's a straight Frankenstein. Says, I'm a religious man, Prendick, as every sane man must be. It may be I fancy that I have seen more of the ways of this world's maker than you, for I have sought his laws in my way all my life, while you, I understand, have been collecting butterflies. And I tell you, pleasure and pain have nothing to do with heaven or hell. This store which men and women set on pleasure and pain, Prendick, is the mark of the beast upon them, the mark of the beast from which they came. Pain, pain, and pleasure, they are for us only so long as we wriggle in the dust. I went on with this research just the way it led me. That is the only way I ever heard of true research going. I asked a question, devised some method of obtaining an answer, and got a fresh question. So again, this experimentation, perhaps it has some trickle-down benefits to humanity, but Moreau is really interested in pursuing it just for the sake of it.
To this day, I have never troubled about the ethics of the matter. The study of nature makes a man at last as remorseless as nature. I have gone on, not heeding anything but the question I was pursuing, and the material has dripped into the huts yonder.
Amazon actually has a copy of this book paired with At the Mountains of Madness by Lovecraft. It's like a double feature book. And you can see why, because the elder things are basically alien Dr. Moreau's. They came to Earth a billion years ago and might have accidentally started life on Earth through arcane experimentation of this type.
Sure.
They created the Shoggoths, which are these blasphemous, formless things to serve as slaves. And then that trickled out into the huts yonder, and that's where we come from. It's very similar.
Moreau explains that he and Montgomery came to the island with six Hawaiian men to do the work, the manual labor. First, the experiment started with sheep, and the Hawaiian men didn't like that much. They didn't like the pain screaming and the torture of the animals, so they decided to set up some huts on the other part of the island to get away from it.
Oh, those superstitious workers. I don't like this.
His first animal man was a gorilla. They taught the gorilla how to talk and how to work. Once Moreau felt that the transition was complete, he took the gorilla over to the Hawaiian village to see if he could pass the test.
As hideous as all this is, I like to think of the gorilla man being kind of nervous about it the night before. You know, and there's like a montage where they try out different outfits.
Moreau told them that the gorilla man was a stowaway, which they accepted, but he could see that they were afraid of this gorilla dude. They were creeped out by him. Eventually, because his temperament was so mild, this gorilla man, they took him in and they taught him more stuff. But unfortunately, the gorilla man regressed. The stubborn beast flesh grows day by day back again.
Yeah, again, that idea of degeneration or de-evolution that we touched on in the last episode. How could it not grow back that way? Because even if you surgically alter the animal, it's got sort of a genetic blueprint for healing up that's going to push it back towards how it was. This is such an interesting theme, though, because on one level, this degeneration theme comes from this fear in society at the time that given less to strive for, humans may de-evolve into a less civilized, more animalistic state. So that's sort of a fear. But also, doesn't that sound kind of good? The beast men in the village are like us. We're all having anxiety and depression and self-loathing because of so-called civilization, right?
Yeah.
I think most people have a tiger hates the cage itch that they want to scratch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you go see Jurassic Park, you're rooting for the dinosaurs. You want the paleontologists to survive. They're natural historians. They didn't interfere with anything.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But you want the monsters to eat those people who created the cages and who caged the beasts. And Michael Crichton was undoubtedly riffing on this book when he wrote Jurassic Park. There are so many similarities, the island, the genetic modification, etc. Or King Kong, you know, you want Kong to punish those people who would take him from his natural ecosystem. We have a natural alliance towards that sort of thing. You see this pop up again and again. Kate and Leopold. It's a common theme, so many iterations.
The gorilla band regressed, but Notch Moreau has higher hopes for this puma that he has just been working on. All the Hawaiian guys that came over with them originally are now dead. Some died by accident. The last three got into a boat and left, which he assumes was just lost at sea. I don't know why he made that assumption, though. But one of the Hawaiian men was killed by one of Moreau's creations. And this is this description of this thing.
It was a limbless thing with a horrible face that writhed along the ground in a serpentine fashion. It was immensely strong and in infuriating pain. It lurked in the woods for some days until we hunted it.
That one was the result of not having the animal-to-man plan.
Yeah.
This was some kind of original organism Moreau was working on for giggles. I don't know what the source material was, but
no.
He was just making a monster for the heck of it, and it was way too scary. He says, after that, I stuck to the ideal of humanity, except for little things. We'll greet those little things later.
Oh, God. And the shape of man is easy for him now to create with 20 years of work under his belt. It's the mind. It's still not quite there, the human mind. And after he does his work, he sees these creatures as human, but the animal traits keep creeping back in. And he says, but I will conquer yet. Each time I dip a living creature into the bath of burning pain, I say, this time I will burn out the animal. This time I will make a rational creature of my own. After all, what is 10 years? Men have been 100,000 in the making. Full mad scientist here. And we never get a good explanation for why, which I think is pretty important. What good is going to come out of making animals into people?
Exactly. I mean, just look at Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes, because instead of special effects, they used all real ape men for that. And that movie was terrible. So, I mean, now we have evidence that this is a waste of time.
Moreau explains. I love that world that you've just created where a filmmaker has created ape men.
Those ape men thought, we got our SAG cards. We're just going to keep getting jobs. But that movie was bad.
Moreau explains that the little village hut contains those that he has turned away, the ones that have too much beast in them. Montgomery, however, has trained a few of those to do some tasks, the ones that still help out around the lab. And Montgomery, he likes them.
Moreau says it's his business, not mine. They only sicken me with a sense of failure. I take no interest in them. I fancy they follow in the lines the Kanaka missionary marked out and have a kind of mockery of a rational life, poor beasts. There's something they call the law, sing hymns about all thine. There's a kind of upward striving in them, part vanity, part waste sexual emotion, part waste curiosity. It only mocks me. So that was interesting because I thought he created their religion in order to keep them in check. But it's something that sort of spontaneously rose up in the civilization. They had met a missionary that perhaps had influenced it. But
yeah, I mean, it sounds like people, really, what he's describing there, humanity.
Because that is what he's describing. That's why it sounds that way.
Moreau asks, "Do you still fear me?" to Prendick. And Prendick thinks about this, and then he offers the guns back to Moreau. And Moreau says, "You know what, keep them." And after that, Prendick feels some security, and he's able to get some sleep.
Things are horrible, but at least he understands them. Nevertheless, I maintain that Prendick is having a pretty bad week overall.
Yes. The next morning, Maling brings out some breakfast.
There's that breakfast you like. Mm. So you're coming to visit me in Madison in about 2 weeks.
Yep.
And we know that right when you come into the house, I've got to offer to fry you an egg.
Yep.
It was just custom. Mm-hmm. But now I got to make it look like a dog cooked it. So I'm really slammed.
He talks with Montgomery, asking how they keep the beastmen from attacking Moreau and Montgomery and each other, because why aren't they all just ripping each other apart? He explains that the hypnotism keeps the idea out of their mind. It just doesn't occur to them, mostly. And the laws help keep those ideas in place. But Prendick saw that beastman breaking the law by getting on all fours and drinking like a beast. Mm-hmm. And the other, who chased him, all against the laws, those acts. Montgomery says that the cat people are the ones that have the hardest time, especially at night. They get more out of control. It was the leopard guy was the one that chased him that first night that he was there.
There's a note about this in the British Library introduction that I quoted in earlier episodes. Hmm. It says, Wells picked up on sensational tales from the far-flung corners of the British Empire in order to give the story a full gothic tone. In this case, Prendick is particularly menaced by a leopard man, surely a reference to the attempts of the British colonial authorities to try to stamp out the secret societies of cannibals in Sierra Leone, known as the Leopard Man Cult.
Oh.
The Island of Dr. Moreau does repeatedly raise the specter of cannibalism as the ultimate taboo that marks out the human from its others. Prendick himself is from the start suspected of surviving alone in the lifeboat of the Lady Vane by drinking the blood of his vanished shipmates. No one can quite be trusted to hold the line. We may have mentioned this cult on Mark of the Beast. I don't remember, but I know we did a story called The Leopard Lady at some point as well, so it could have been on that. I don't know, but this Leopard Man cult sounds familiar.
It does sound familiar to me as well. Prendick explains to the reader that the island is only some 7 or 8 square miles in size, so not very big. Mm. It's volcanic in origin and has coral reefs around 3 sides of it. There are around 60 beast people, mostly male, but some female. And Montgomery says that some of them actually had offspring.
Life finds a way, Chris. Life finds a way.
Most of them didn't survive long. And those that did went under Moreau's process to become more human.
What a downer.
Oh, God. It's terrible. Now, Prendick describes the beast people as having long bodies and shorter arms and legs. They also have malformed ears, large noses, bristly hair. They could not laugh, but the ape man could titter, and their hands were often malformed.
When I was reading, I had the feeling that Wells was being inconsistent about whether the creatures could laugh or not.
Yes.
I liked the idea that they could not laugh. That made their existence so much more horrible. But it seems that later on in the book, he's talking about their laughter ringing out in the night. But I'll keep an eye out for that. But what I loved about this section was Prendick saying, "So relative is our idea of grace. My eye became habituated to their forms. And at last I even fell in with their persuasion that my own long thighs were ungainly." I just loved that. Humans are a cooperative species. It's why we're successful. But that means conformity is instinctual to an extent.
Yeah.
The nail that sticks out gets hammered down. Studies show that folks tend to take on the sizes and shapes and styles of their peer groups. So if you spend all day scrolling through photos of beast people on Instagram, you're probably going to feel the same way as Prendick.
They're too dangerous. The two dangerous ones of the beast people are the leopard man that chased Prendick and the hyena swine man. There's also some bull men and whatever the sayer of the law was. They don't really explain what he was.
Got bird hands and looks like Bela Lugosi. That's all we know.
There's Maling. There's also some satyr-like ape goat men, 3 swine men, and a swine woman.
That's a great sitcom title. I'm claiming that one.
It's all yours.
3 swine men, a swine woman, and a pizza place.
There's a horse rhinoceros woman. There are wolf men. I think earlier episode, I wasn't sure if there was wolf men or not. There are, in fact, wolf men. A bear bull man, a St. Bernard man, and a vixen bear woman, plus sloth boy, and a ton of others. It's just a whole mishmash of things.
Yeah. By the way, because of scheduling, we're having to record these episodes in sort of a big batch. So apologies to anybody who told us in comments already that there are indeed werewolves or made any other corrections that you're not hearing us mention. We'll call those out in next month's feedback show.
Now, I want to know, how fast is he churning out these creatures? Because if there's like 60 of them and he's been there for 10 years, that's like one every 2 months. But since a lot of them have died, it's got to be way more than that. So he must be making Beast Boys in a couple weeks.
Whatever kind of healing ointment he's using, that's what he should be sharing with the world.
Exactly. That's insane. Like any kind of major surgery, even nowadays, takes weeks or months to heal.
Absolutely.
If he's able to get these guys up and running around and doing manual labor with completely new bodies, that's nuts. Share that info, Moreau. Now, over time, Prendick gets used to these creatures. And watching the beast people work, he says, you know, they're not really that different than the working class that he's seen back in England.
Oof.
Oh, that is cold.
Well, it's called a Cockney accent for a reason. When the Romans moved into England around the year 43, it was full of chicken people.
Oh.
Yeah. So you were brought up in the American school system, but your kids probably know that. Ask them.
I will ask my children.
Ask them to tell you about the chicken people.
Chicken people. Prendick even admits to looking at some of the females sexually, but seeing the hints of the beast in them, it turns him off.
Yeah, we'll talk about this more in our bonus episode on the movies, but almost all of them feature a panther woman as a love interest.
Yes.
Probably because of this mention, but, you know, Prendick shouldn't feel bad.
He shouldn't feel bad. And again, I like to point out he is not necessarily a reliable narrator.
Oh, yeah.
So he might be saying, oh, no, I wasn't into it, but...
Because he got dumped. That's what happened. The panther woman dumped him, and he's like, well, looking back, I didn't like any of them. That gets us all the way to chapter 16, how the beast folk taste blood. Uh-oh.
Oh, boy. After breakfast, Montgomery and Prendick go out for a walk on the island with whips and guns. This is so creepy. Montgomery called my attention to a certain little pink animal with long hind legs that went leaping through the undergrowth. He told me they were creatures made of the offspring of the beast people that Moreau had invented. He had fancied that they might serve for meat, but a rabbit-like habit of devouring their young had defeated this intention. Oh, God, what a horror show.
Also, thanks, Wells. I didn't know that rabbits do that.
Oh.
It's spring, and they're all over the yard, and I was happy, but now I see them as little baby cannibals. Thanks.
They catch one of these child things, and Prendick gives it a once-over. It tries to attack him, but its little mouth is ineffectual. Like, it bites him, but it doesn't even hurt. It doesn't leave a mark or anything. And Prendick says, I should imagine it might prove a convenient substitute for the common rabbit in a gentleman's park. So terrible. And, of course, we get some anti-Semitic remarks. We've skipped over the racist language in this book so far. For its time, it's not as prevalent as one would have thought, especially with the subject matter.
Yeah, I would have thought. But, you know, Wells was a pretty progressive guy. It's there, for sure.
Now, as they walk, Montgomery and Prendick see Ape Man and Seder-looking guy. The Beastmen are confused because Prendick now has a whip, and they thought he was made like them. So they refer to Prendick as he that walks weeping into the sea has a thin white face. It's a bit cold, you know, like kind of the most embarrassing thing that he did was the one that they call
that's
him by.
Yeah. It's Crybaby.
We call him Crybaby. Yesterday he bled and wept, said the satyr. You never bleed nor weep. The master does not bleed or weep. So Montgomery's like, okay, stop this line of thought. Shut up. We're not going to talk about this. But the seed of questioning is there. Either humans can be weak or animals can be elevated. So which did we get here? You know, they're able to see that. It's like, well, if this guy's not an animal, then he's a human and humans can be weak, which is what you are. But if he's an animal, then he gets a whip now, too? So why don't one of us get a whip?
Prendick is the change agent in the society. So if Moreau is the merciless god, I think he's kind of the Christ figure.
Whoa.
They thought it was one of them, but it turns out he is part god.
I didn't thought about that before.
Yeah, bro.
As they walk on, they find another dead rabbit ripped apart, and obviously they've been eating the meat. Strangely, this is the first time that Montgomery has seen this, and Prendick relates that he found another ripped apart rabbit earlier. And Montgomery thinks, oh boy, this is not good. He says that they need to prove that it's the leopard guy. And if he did do it, he's got to be punished. So they go back, tell Moreau, who takes it very seriously, and says an example must be made.
It feels to me that it would have been better to let the carnivorous animals go ahead and eat some rabbits rather than resisting the instinct until they freak out, you know? But what do I know? I haven't even made one beast man, so I guess I shouldn't be casting aspersions.
Yeah, armchair vivisectionist. That afternoon, they go to the beast people's village, and Moreau blows a horn, and they all gather, except for the leopard man and the ape man. So he blows the horn again, and finally the stragglers come. Moreau calls forth the sayer of the laws, and he tells them to say the words. So they chant through them, but when they get to the not eat flesh bit, he stops them. So, all right, no, that law has been broken. Then all of the beast people, when they hear this, they start chanting, "None escape, none escape," which is really creepy.
They were created with such horrific pain that, of course, they're just creatures of pure fear. That's how they were born into the world, you know.
But they're getting excited about somebody getting punished.
This is not them.
Exactly. So who did it? Asks Moreau. Brendig notes that hyena swine and leopard man both look guilty.
They don't know not to look back and forth side to side when they're accused of something. They're just standing over there going,
So the sayer of the law says, "Who breaks the law goes back to the house of pain."
Whee!
Moreau looks right at the leopard man, and then suddenly leopard man attacks Moreau. They tussle, and Prendick thinks that it's going to be a full revolt. All the beastmen are starting to flip out, but Moreau's pistol cracks, and the leopard man runs off. The other beastmen realize that this is their cue to hunt, and they love it.
Yeah, it suddenly turns into like a party. They just go after him. It's like a fox hunt suddenly.
Prendick says that he's just caught up in it. They all just start moving around him, and he's all of a sudden he's running with a mob. It's madness.
It's such a crazy scene.
Prendick notices that the hyena swine is looking at him. Is he on the leopard man's side? Is he going to help leopard man out, or is he just bloodthirsty? We don't know. A little bit of danger there. Prendick and the hyena swine get close to the leopard man. All the beast people are chanting, "House of pain, house of pain."
Then suddenly, through a polygon of green, in the half-darkness under the luxuriant growth, I saw the creature we were hunting. I halted. He was crouched together into the smallest possible compass, his luminous green eyes turned over his shoulder, regarding me.
Prendick can see the humanity in this poor creature, and he decides that he doesn't want it to suffer, so he shoots it in the head. Dead. The hyena swine immediately jumps on the dead leopard man and starts biting his throat.
Yikes.
Moreau finally catches up, whips the hyena swine off, and chastises Prendick for killing Leopard Man. Prendick, at this point, doesn't seem to give a toss what Moreau thinks. And he's like, "This is all BS. This is all crazy."
Had Moreau had any intelligible object, I could have sympathized at least a little with him. I am not so squeamish about pain as that. I could have forgiven him a little, even, had his motive been only hate. But he was so irresponsible, so utterly careless. His curiosity, his mad, aimless investigations drove him on. And the things were thrown out to live a year or so, to struggle and blunder and suffer, and at last to die painfully. They were wretched in themselves. The old animal hate moved them to trouble one another. The law held them back from a brief hot struggle and a decisive end to their natural animosities. In those days, my fear of the beast people went the way of my personal fear for Moreau. I fell indeed into a morbid state, deep and enduring, and alien to fear, which has left permanent scars upon my mind. I must confess that I lost faith in the sanity of the world when I saw it suffering the painful disorder of this island. A blind fate, a vast, pitiless mechanism seemed to cut and shape the fabric of existence, and I, Moreau, by his passion for research, Montgomery, by his passion for drink, the beast people, with their instincts and mental restrictions, were torn and crushed ruthlessly, inevitably, amid the infinite complexity of its incessant wheels. But this condition did not come all at once. I think, indeed, that I anticipate a little in speaking of it now.
I think that's a good place to halt before our thrilling conclusion. It's right before a little time break where we jump ahead to see how he's dealing with all of this. I mean, that little quote there, it seems like almost a scree against God.
Yeah.
If you had any reason for all of this, I could forgive it. But this is just insane.
Yeah.
Our lives are short and wretched and for nothing, even though we've held up your law. It's definitely got those religious angles on it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why this book is so fascinating, because it's a combination of thoughts on the state of mankind as well as warnings about science without restriction or ethics.
Yeah, it's a lot of great stuff packed into this awesome text. Speaking of awesome text, I want to thank the man that's reading it for us, Andrew Lehman.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Please go to the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society and pick up great stuff. I know that you already do. Keep doing it. It's what's good for you. I also want to thank some of our patrons, and I'm going to start by thanking David Elwell.
Vril Docs, thank you.
Richard Linville, thank you.
Njal Nordmark, thank you.
Brian Hallfacker, thank you.
Toddy Gearing, thank you.
Pretty Boy Void, thank you. That's the most new wave band. Pretty Boy Void? Wow.
Love it. Jitesh, thank you.
Jeremy Tanner, thank you.
And lastly, I want to thank Liana.
Liana, Jitesh, all of you sound like you're in the band Pretty Boy Void. We thank you so much for supporting the show. We need it. We're going to be back with the conclusion of The Island of Dr. Moreau next time. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
The mind plays tricks on you sometimes. It's better to let yourself unwind. Peering into nature, unkind. When you make a man, you're a god for a time. Now we play this game and we race for rhyme. I've lost everything to you, but what's my crime? What's my crime? When you make a monster, you can't rewind, can't rewind. When you make a monster, nothing's fine, nothing's fine. On your heels a god and he has lost his mind, lost his mind. Wrath, damnation, revelation. I will see you around.